Bobby, I'd like to welcome you to political thought through the ages. I was originally scheduled to teach also during this month another course besides this one on Atlas Shrugged, but the Atlas Shrugged post, the course, was postponed till next month. I was very glad that Danny Sanchez suggested postponing the Atlas Shrugged course, because that'll give me time to read the book. You know, I always think it's better to read the book before you teach a course on it, although I suppose it isn't essential, but I prefer it that way. Somebody laughed. Now, for those of you who haven't taken any of my courses before or haven't taken any Mises Academy courses, I'd just like to say a little bit about how the program works. I will generally lecture for about an hour or so, and then after that, we have the rest of the time will be for discussion, questions, anything you want to talk about. And you can, if you want, even during the lecture, you can post remarks in the chat box. I don't always respond to them right away, but you can put them there if you want. And I have to be careful about what, making sure that I have the right time for these for the discussion. I gave a couple weeks ago, I gave a webinar. It was just a one lecture course on Henry Hazlitt, Foundations of Morality. You'll see Henry Hazlitt features in this lecture too a little bit. But I assumed in that course that after my lecture, I'd have half hour for discussion, but it had actually been scheduled for an hour. I had an extra hour of discussion, so just when I thought I was finishing, I found I had an extra half hour to go, so I have to be very careful about these things. Now, one other detail about how the course works. For those of you who want to take the course for credit, there's a strictly voluntary quiz I give every week, which consists of 10 multiple choice questions. And I should say, I try to make these quizzes fairly easy. I'm not interested in trying to trick you. So if you want to take the quiz, it's I think you'll find it a good way to see if you know you get some of the main points of the lecture. I believe in exams. I always follow the advice of my greatest teacher, Walter Starkey, used to say, give all A's and B's, that way you build up a following. Now, what I want to do in this course, you know, we're covering a vast topic, which is the history of political thought. We're covering a vast amount of time. The person that we're talking today about Plato's Republic. Now, Plato lived, was born in between, depending on who you read, either 428 or 427 BC, and he died around 347 BC, which is a long time ago. And we're ending with Murray Rothbard, who just died in January 1995. That's a vast stretch of time. So how are we going to cover such a vast stretch of time? Well, what I wanted to do, I thought, would be to organize the course around some central questions or themes. And what will be, when we're doing the reading each week, which will be on one of the classics, couple of the classics of political philosophy, we're going to be trying to answer two related questions. And I selected these questions because I think that they're especially important for libertarians. you're certainly not required to be a libertarian to take this course, but I assume many of you are. So one question is, what view does the text take about human rights? As you know, libertarians think that each person is a self-owner. Each person has the right of control over his or her own body. So we want to know, when we're looking at these texts, how does the author of the particular text feel about that? Does he think that we have the same rights that standard libertarian theory thinks we do, or in fact do the authors of the text think people have rights at all? And as we'll see, there's some of the writers we'll be considering don't think so, or at least they don't think of rights in the way we do. And then very much related to this, there's a very common assumption that most of the writers that we'll be considering held, but Murray Rothbard and Lysander Spooner, whom we talked about in the last lecture, did not hold, which is that it's justifiable or even morally required that a state exists, a society requires a state, and that people owe the state a duty of obedience. We ought, in the view of many of the great political thinkers, we ought to obey the state. And we can see this is very much related to the first question, that if people have certain rights, maybe this precludes our duty to obey the state. I'm not saying that immediately evident, but we might want to think that. So we can see how these two questions are related. If we want to say, do people have rights, and are people required to obey the state? Should there be a state, and are people required to obey it? Now, before I start onto the text we'll be talking about today, which is Plato's Republic, is one of the great, if not the great classics of philosophy. Perhaps if you had to list, say, the two or three most famous works in all of philosophy, not just political philosophy, in all of philosophy, Plato's Republic would certainly be on that list. I wanted to give, before I start on Plato, an objection to the program I've set out. I said we're going to be considering these two questions. Do people have rights? What are those rights? And is there due to obedience of state? So the objection that some people would give, for example, the British philosopher R.G. Collingwood in his essay on metaphysics, and other people like Michel Foucault, maybe Thomas Kuhn, although Thomas Kuhn didn't write about political philosophy, but we can see kind of a Kuhnian objection to what I'm doing. And the objection would be this, that I'm asking the same question, do people have rights, and do we have a duty of obedience to state? I'm asking the same question for every writer that we're considering, even though these writers in very different historical periods. Athens, in the 5th century BC, is a very different society from 20th century America, when Rothbard was writing. So some people, say like Collingwood, would say political philosophers, because they're living in different societies, are really addressing different questions. And it's a mistake to think that thinkers are always talking about the same issue. So this objection would be, I'm taking an unhistorical approach because I'm asking these same questions. Do people have rights, and is a duty of obedience to state? So I'm assuming that that question really is the same question, means the same thing for all these different writers. And this objection is no, political philosophers at different periods, political thinkers were concerned with different questions. Now, I raise this objection, so maybe you're expecting that I have a refutation of it, but I don't have a general refutation in the sense that I have some argument that shows that this view that political philosophers are addressing different questions has to be false. We'll just have to see how much our way of looking at things helps us understand the text. So all I can say to this objection is, well, let's try to do it my way. I'm not Frank Sinatra, but let's do it my way and see what happens. Now, in The Republic, as I say, is one of the great classics, an enormous amount has been written about it. But I think in trying to understand what's going on in The Republic, it's helpful to see Plato is concerned with two main issues. First of all, what is justice, and why should people care about being just? And it very much a question that goes along with it, is the just person happy? I mean, supposing justice, following the rules of justice, if you're a just person, this would make you miserable. You'd be end your life in suffering. That would seem like a reason not to be just. So it's very important to consider, is a just person happy? And related to this, how should the ideal city, so supposing we're trying to construct a city, and Plato's talking about cities because remember, in Greece at his time, in the dominant form of organization was the city-state. So unlike today, say if you're in Los Angeles, I'm in Los Angeles, maybe a lot of you are in other cities, the city will just be part one within a country. In Greece, at the time Plato was writing, the cities were independent. You would say the city and the state were the same thing. Some of the Greek cities were sometimes bound to each other in alliances, like the famous Amphitheatic League of Athens, but the cities were independent. So Plato calls this ideal city in the Republic Kallipolis, which means the beautiful city. And he's asking, how should this be organized? And you can see how these two questions are related in that if we're coming up with the ideal city, we would presumably want it to be a city where justice prevails. So we can see how the two questions are very closely related, and we'll see later on a particular kind of relation Plato finds between these two questions. He thinks, to anticipate a little bit, thinking about or trying to construct the ideal city will help us answer the first question of what is justice and why people should care about being just. Now, to just go on with what I've been saying, we want to know, why does Plato discuss both these questions in the same book? I mean, it's not obvious that you would have to do that. I mean, you could conceive of somebody writing a book about justice, trying to get what are the principles of justice, or should we be just, or if we should, or what are the reasons to be just. And you wouldn't think you'd have to also write about what the ideal society is. It seemed like maybe you think that's a separate project. Why would you have to put together? It's not that there's anything incongruous in putting together, but why would you want to deal with them in the same book? And what Plato thinks is that there's a parallel between the parts of the human soul. The soul is just saying this, the mind. So he thinks that the mind is organized in a certain way, and the city is all should also be organized in parallel to the way the mind is organized. So, as we'll see, the mind, according to Plato, is organized in kind of a three-part division, and the ideal city is also organized in this in a three-part division. So by studying the ideal city, we can learn something about how the soul should be organized. He said, the city is the soul written large. So something like if we put a magnifying glass to the soul or the mind, and we do that, we see the city. So by studying the city, then we could learn things about the mind. Now I just saw kind of an interesting point someone raised. Someone suggested that it's right to compare thought, political thought from different periods, because philosophers from previous periods have influenced later thinkers. I think that's a very good point, that philosophers from earlier periods, writers from earlier periods like Plato, influenced later thinkers like Plato and Rousseau, and we'll be studying later. You see, that wouldn't really be enough to refute Collingwood, or people who say, political philosophers are asking separate questions in different historical periods, because what they would say is, sure, they're influenced by previous writers, but they're transforming what the previous writers have said in terms of the questions relevant to their own time. So they say, sure, you're right, previous writers have influenced later writers, but that doesn't follow from that everyone's answering the same questions, you see. But that was a good point. Now, I want to say again now that the fact that Plato is dealing with these two questions on what is justice and why we should be just on the one hand, and what's the nature of the ideal city, will help us answer the questions that we pose, namely, what do people have rights, and do we have an obligation to obey the state? And as we'll see, Plato thinks that the way Plato would answer our question, and we can get his answer from his construction of the ideal city, is that people have to obey the rulers of the state, and he doesn't think that individuals have rights against the state. So he's answering in a way that would be very much against what libertarians would say. Say if you take a libertarian position, you'd say individuals do have rights, and at least you agree with Rothbard that we don't have any obligation to obey the state. In fact, the state shouldn't exist at all. So Plato is saying we do have to obey the state, and individuals don't have rights against the state. Now, even though Plato holds this anti-individualist view, he isn't completely anti-individualist. Because he asks, why should an individual be just? Why does being just make him or her happier? So the fact that he's asking this shows he isn't indifferent to the individual. He doesn't say something like, even if being just isn't to a particular individual's advantage, or it doesn't make any person happier, it's still your obligation to sacrifice yourself for the state. He doesn't reject, as we'll see, he doesn't reject sacrifice, but he doesn't think that the happiness of individuals is irrelevant either. So he's not completely anti-individuals. Now, the way the Republic is written, it's not, as some of the text will be stated, it's not a statement by the author. It's not a book by Plato where he just gives his own opinion. Say, if you read Human Action by Mises, it'll be giving you what Mises thinks of all various topics. But the Republic is organized as a dialogue. It's between Socrates, who is Plato's teacher. Socrates, I think, lived from 469 BC and died, one of the most famous dates in history, 399 BC. That's one date you should remember, 399 BC, the date of Socrates' death. So the Republic is dialogues between Socrates and various people. And this raises a problem of interpretation, because if you have a book written by an author where he's speaking in his own person, you can say, well, though that's what he says, those are his views. But in a dialogue, philosophical dialogue, it's not, you can't take for granted that what a particular person is saying reflects what the author thinks. It's just an opinion he's put into the mouth of the characters. But I think in the Republic, we can take what he attributes to Socrates as his own views. Now, there's a further question I want to raise before we get into the meat of the argument here. Is in the Republic, is Plato, when he's speaking, putting words in Socrates' mouth, is he giving really his own views, or is he reporting more what Socrates held? And most scholars think that he's giving his own views. There is a view which was held by great Greek scholar, Scottish scholar John Burnet, and also held by his pupil and colleague A.E. Taylor, that Plato was really accurately reporting the views of the historical Socrates, but most people don't think that. I should say, just in passing, you know, there's a story about one writer who was the one time, I think it was the secretary, the head of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the later Secretary of Education under Reagan, who supposedly recommended the collected works of Socrates to people. And of course, Socrates never wrote anything, but that didn't stop this person from recommending him. So now, with that as background, we want to get to the Socrates raises the question with various people of what is justice. Now, the first person he talks to in the dialogue who raises this question about what is justice is named Cephalus, who's a very old and rich man. Now, I think it's significant that he's having this discussion with Cephalus, because sometimes people say, for the Greeks, I mentioned this already, that life was entirely dependent on what's called the polis, which is the city-state. I mentioned before that Greece at that time was organized into independent city-states. So some people say, and there's a lot of truth in this view, that for the Greeks, their life was entirely bound up with the city-state. You remember when Socrates is condemned to death, he has the opportunity to escape, but he says, well, I'm not going to escape because life for me, apart from my city, is really not something I want. Incidentally, can anybody tell me what was Socrates' last words? Anybody know that? He said, no, yeah, that's right, Jeff has got it. I drank the what? Okay, so for one example, someone who, a very famous book came out in the 19th century by the French historian Poussin de Courage called The Ancient City. And this is a book set that for the Greeks of that time, life was entirely dependent on the polis. But we should notice that this is a significant part about Plato having Socrates talk to Cephalus, is that although Plato is influenced by this view, he doesn't accept it completely. How do you know that? Because Cephalus is not a citizen, he's a resident alien, what's called a Metic, M-E-T-I-C, not to be confused with Metic, Metic. So Socrates is willing to talk to people who aren't citizens, so that shows he's able to consider people really apart from the city-state. And I got this point, I don't know whether he originated it, but I got this from one of the great Plato scholar, A. Taylor, who noted this point. Taylor, if you want to look at Taylor's book on Plato, it shows he had an amazing knowledge of also Greek society and history. He read absolutely everything, and very often can get very good points from it. So Cephalus says to Socrates, in answer question, what is justice? He says that, and this is an answer you'll find many people give, he says, well, justice is just following the customary rules, for example, paying your debts. If you owe something to somebody, you ought to pay it. So that's an example of what justice means. Now, Socrates, thanks for asking, very penetrating questions that are supposed to show the people that their problems with it. He says, well, does this always give the right results? And he says something like, well, what if the murderer asks for his knife back? You borrowed a knife from somebody, and let's say you have good reason to think that if you give it back to the person, he's going to go out and stab somebody. Should you give it back to him? And Socrates suggests, really, maybe you shouldn't. So if that's right, then what Cephalus says is wrong. So he doesn't really say all that much about Cephalus. He kind of dismisses what he's saying. It's just kind of background for to get the discussion going. Now, the next person he talks to is Thrasymachus, and there was a real Thrasymachus who was a well-known Greek sophist. Now, a sophist is someone who teaches rhetoric. What is it? Rhetoric is the art of persuasion. So rhetoric was, you think of it now as something you study in English departments. You know, it's really just kind of, maybe people think of rhetoric as fancy writing or something like that. But when the Greeks thought of rhetoric, it was much more serious. It was especially useful in legal disputes. That's called forensic rhetoric. So it would be very important to learn how to persuade people. And there were people like Thrasymachus who taught rhetoric. Of course, they'd get paid for this. And Socrates is usually considered an opponent of the sophist, although there are some people like the great 19th century scholar of Greek philosophy, George Grote, who's also a friend of John Stuart Mill, who thought Socrates was himself a sophist. But Thrasymachus was one of the most famous of the sophists. And what he says in response to what Socrates' question, I mean, what is justice? He says justice is the interest of the stronger. And so the picture he has that in people struggling against each other and the stronger wins is able to establish its own rules, say, if we live in a society that's run by the rich people, then they'll set up a society favoring rich people. If you have the dictator, he'll set up the rules so that he gets what he wants. So the pictures Thrasymachus has is people are fighting each other, and the one who's the strongest is the one whose views prevail. So this view is like what's later been called social Darwinism. First, Darwin was in the 19th century, and this is long before Darwin. It's a very similar view to that, where that view is there's a struggle in nature between the strong and the weak, and it's the strong who wins. So we shouldn't try to help the weak, because this is just really interfering with the course of progress. But really, what's going on in history is kind of just the struggle where the stronger, the better ones are coming to prevail. Now, incidentally, just not really relevant to the Republic, but it's not going to stop me from mentioning it. Most of the so-called social Darwinists, such as Herbert Spencer and William Graham Sumner, really didn't hold this view, namely that there's a struggle between the strong and the weak, and we shouldn't help the weak because it's good that they perish. There were actual social Darwinists, but the people who generally are thought of as social Darwinists didn't hold that view. But Thrasymachus really anticipates the view, because he said justice is the interest of the stronger. And you'll find a similar view in another dialogue of Plato called the Gorgias, and this character is called Callicles. He gives this same view. There's E.R. Dodds, who is a great Irish classical scholar, later taught at Oxford, has a famous essay where he compares Callicles with Nietzsche. So you have this view that justice is the interest of the stronger, which is held by Thrasymachus in the Republic, and also by Callicles in this other dialogue. Now, what Socrates responds to Thrasymachus, he doesn't accept what Thrasymachus says. He says, well, it's obvious if Thrasymachus is right, then this is going to lead to conflict. In fact, the whole idea is based on conflict, because it's saying that the stronger, just as the interest of the stronger, presumably not in the interest of the weaker. So there's a struggle between the strong and the weak. So what Socrates says, well, if you have true justice, it should produce harmony both in the person himself and in society. I should have added that in the slide. So he's saying, look, Thrasymachus is wrong, because Thrasymachus is saying there's conflict in society because the stronger is struggling to impose their will on the less strong, but a truly just society will be one of harmony. And a real ruler is not somebody who's just trying to advance what's good for himself or for herself, but a real ruler is acting for the good of the people. Now, there's one very controversial writer on history of political philosophy, named Leo Strauss. Probably some of you have read him. He thinks that Plato really didn't refute the view that power really is the ethics of the city. So what Strauss said is Socrates really didn't answer Thrasymachus, but all that he was, what Plato is doing, according to Strauss, he's just thinking there's a philosophical ethics as well. There's a view of justice as harmony that the philosophers can hold when they're kind of doing philosophy, and that they can be very happy trying to be harmonious and having these nice conversations, but still what's going on in the city is a struggle for power. But that's a minority position, but I think it is worth noting. Now coming to what I think is the real action in the book, which is the discussion between Socrates and two people, Glaucon and Adeimantus, and these two people are brothers. And they were Glaucon was a brother of Plato. That isn't mentioned in the dialogue, but there was a Glaucon who was Plato's brother. So what they say that Glaucon and Adeimantus say, well, one way to justify morality, one way to say why we should follow the rules of justice is, somebody asked for a source on Leo Strauss. Well, you might look at a book by him called The City and Man. It's his interpretation of the Republic. That's one you could get on Leo Strauss. But so what Glaucon and Adeimantus say is one way to look at justice and morality in general is that it rests on an agreement among everyone in society. So their idea is this, they say, well, everyone would prefer a situation in which he could do whatever he wanted. Suppose I could just do whatever I wanted, but everybody else followed the rules of morality, so I could go out and steal whenever I wanted. Say I saw something, I saw a nice book in a bookstore, but it costs too much money, I could just take it whenever I wanted, but other people wouldn't do that to me or wouldn't do that to each other. But this isn't really a possible situation, because if everybody tried to do that, we just have chaos. We wouldn't really be able to exist in society if each person just tried to do whatever he wanted. So what the best we can do is say each person wants to get the most freedom for himself, so we should accept certain common rules or limits. Within these limits, we can do whatever we like. So we all follow certain general rules, like not to kill or assault one another and not to steal property from other people. But if everybody observes these rules, then we can all get the most freedom that we can. Now, I think it's interesting here, one thing very interesting, this is a view is very close to, if not identical with, the view of morality by Ludwig von Mises and Henry Hazlitt. Now, perhaps some of you may come to it. A couple weeks ago, I gave a one lecture webinar on Henry Hazlitt's book, Foundations of Morality, and this is pretty much exactly the view Hazlitt has, that morality, it's in all of our interests to limit ourselves. The ideal situation for everybody would be, I can do whatever I want, but this will lead to problems because people are getting each other's way and interfere with each other. So we're all better off if we just observe certain limits and can all cooperate with each other. So we can conclude that Glaucon and Adeimantus read Henry Hazlitt. You see, they're coming up with the same view, so they must have read Henry Hazlitt, but they got the same view. Now, one thing we should understand here is one block on the Adimantic is giving this view that morality really rests on a common agreement that's to everyone's advantage. That's the basis of justice. It isn't the view they're themselves advocating. What they're trying to do is say to Socrates, well, can you come up with a better view than this? Because this view, in their opinion, has certain problems. And what are the problems with this view? When I gave the lecture on Hazard, it seems like Hazard and Needle have a very plausible view, but why don't we just say, well, okay, now we have the answer to what justice is and why we should be just, so Plato doesn't have to go on with the rest of the dialogue. Well, that would have spoiled things for him. But the objections that Lacan and Adimantis raised, they say, first, the view implies that people are immoral, because on this view, we say, well, the ideal situation is people can do whatever they like, so then this implies we would all really like to kill or steal if we could get away with it, but really we accept moral restraints as a second best. So they say, well, isn't this an objection to the Henry Hazlitt's view? So they would have probably given this objection to Hazlitt, but for the fact he wasn't alive then, but somehow they were able to read his book before he got there. Now, and another objection, I think this is really the major objection, is that they say that this line of defense, namely the arguing that justice is to everybody's advantage, because if we all accept these limits that we all agree not to use violence against each other, then we'll all be better off. They say this doesn't show that justice is good in itself. So what do they mean by that? Well, they say the argument is that observing the principles of justice has good consequences. That if we all observe these limits, then we'll be free to cooperate with each other. We won't have to worry about, say, walking down the street. You don't have to worry somebody's going to stab you in the back or shoot you. So we're all better off. But that's just saying observing the principles of justice has good consequences. But what they ask for of Socrates is to show that people should value being just, not just the consequences of justice, but they should, Socrates should try to show that justice itself is something good. So not just instrumentally good, but it's good in itself. Now, to bring home this challenge, Glaucon mentions the Ring of Gyges, which is legend. It's a peasant who found a ring, and then he found when he put the ring on and turned it a certain way, it would make him invisible. Then he goes to the palace and seduces the queen. They arrange to kill the king, and then he becomes the ruler. So the notion of the ring is, well, if you were invisible, you could do whatever you want without any bad consequences. Would you still have a reason to be moral? Would you still have a reason to follow the principles of justice if you could get away with it without any consequences if you didn't? So you see, this is bringing home this challenge, because the argument that Glaucon and Adimantis are considering, and the Henry Hazlitt argument, is justice, we follow the rules of justice because we're all better off if everybody follows these rules, but what if you could get away with it if you didn't follow the rules? I'm always trying to understand there's something a bit odd about the Ring of Gyges, and it's supposed to make you invisible, But I guess it would have to make the ring invisible too, because otherwise you just see a ring going around assaulting people or doing bad things to people. So I guess the ring has to be invisible too. Now, incidentally, the ring of Gyges, probably or early, certainly influenced Tolkien in Lord of the Rings. Remember, the ring in features very much in there. For example, the character Gollum is under the ring's influence for long periods, and he loses the ring, goes in search of it. So this notion of a ring that makes you invisible is very influential on, Tolkien. Now, I think we need to be clear about what G&A, I'll just refer to Glaucon, now I remind us of G&A, it's a little easier. What are they asking? What is it that Socrates is going to try to provide them as an answer? Now, there's one view that the laws of morality exist and exert an absolute force on them. And I suppose you say something like in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. It's just something you're obligated to do. You have to do it just because that's your duty. Tennyson says in Charge of the Light Brigade, there is not the question why, there is but to do and die. So just something, it's an absolute requirement on you. Now, the great 18th century German philosopher Immanuel Kant held this view. He said, if something is your duty, you have to do the thing just out of respect for duty. Say, if you have a duty to visit the sick, you can't do it because you just have to like the sick person you enjoy visiting. You have to do it out of your absolute duty to do this, if in fact that is your duty. And there's an essay I think everybody should read if you have a chance, by the British 20th century British philosopher who taught at Oxford, H.A. Pritchard, called Does Moral Philosophy Rest on the State, which came out of Mind magazine 1912. And what did he mean by that, asking does it rest on the state? Well, he said, moral philosophers very often say, why should I be moral? Meaning, is there some non-moral reason to be moral? I suppose you say, well, you should be follow rules of justice because we'll all be better off if we follow the rules of justice. So what Pritchard said is, this is a mistake because it suggests that morality has to be grounded on something else. In fact, we just have these moral rules, and they're just obligations that we have to follow. They're just there, we have to do them. And what I think is important to realize is that Socrates, in the dialogue in Plato, of course, speaking through Socrates, do not take this view. So what they're going to be, Plato's going to be answering Glaucon and Ademandus, and what they want is not some argument that the principles of justice are just there, that we have to follow them just because they're there. We have an absolute duty to follow them. That's not what they want when they question this argument that it's to our advantage to be just. What they want to say, what they're asking is, does justice itself make the just person happy? So the argument, kind of the Henry Hazlitt argument, is, well, we'll all be better off or happier if we follow the rules of justice, because then we'll have we'll be able to cooperate with each other and be able to make peaceful exchanges. But what the objection is, and what Socrates is trying to come up with, is trying to show that really observing the rules of justice itself is making you happy. So you're happy just by not assaulting people or by respecting others' properties. Not just that it has good consequences, it's they're not denying that it has good consequences, but they say you have to show that it itself produces happiness. And what is the argument does, it doesn't sound like, suppose I just walk by, I see a book that I want to steal and I don't take it. So it doesn't seem like, well, that's going to make me happy, just not taking the book. It'll lead to good consequences if everybody, including me, follows it. But why is that supposed to be making us happy? Well, the argument that Plato gives here is that the just person is one who will harmonize his desires and his spirit under the control of reason. So the Platonic view is that the mind or the soul has three parts. There's reason, then there's our desires, and there's the spirit, which is kind of the will. Say we make a choice, we have to will ourselves to do it. Let me give you an example. See, as you probably can tell by looking at me, if you don't know me, I'm very old and I go to the senior citizen gym near where I live. So suppose I say, well, I think out, I say, well, my reason is, by reason I should go to the gym, it would be good for me to go, but say I don't feel like going, I'm kind of tired, I don't want to do it, so then I decide I should do it anyway, so I have to kind of get myself to do it, I have to will myself to go to the, get out there and start exercising. So this is this third part of the part, so is the spirit, the will. So that's in the argument that Plato's giving, is justice makes us happy because it's going to harmonize our desires and spirit under the control of reason. So the just person will be happy because he won't be in conflict with himself or herself. He'll be a harmonious person, harmonious mind. Now we should note, this is a quite unusual view, because the view isn't that if you have this harmonious soul, then this is going to produce happiness in some sense, where happiness is something other than the harmonious soul. The view is that happiness consists of being just. So happiness consists of having your soul in this harmonious arrangement where your desires, say, aren't conflicting with your reason, where all the parts of the soul are unified. So that's saying, well, that's what happiness is. I mean, it seems open to counterexamples, because in supposing, say, somebody's being tortured, well, we'd say, well, you're probably not going to be very happy. But on this view, as long as his mind was harmonious, then he would be happy. This is actually a view that some of the Stoics held, that really the mind is really can detach itself completely from what's going on in the outer world. But whether you think it's a plausible view or not, that was the view, that the just person is happy because happiness consists of being just, namely of having the mind harmonious in the way I've tried to explain. Now, there's a famous article that came out in Philosophical Review 1963, I should have the P capitalized it, called The Fallacy in Plato's Republic by David Sacks. He was a very good philosophy, specialized in ancient philosophy, also wrote on Wittgenstein and other things. So he said, well, Plato doesn't really answer the challenge that Locke and Arimantis have posed, because what they're talking about is, they want to say, well, show why justice is good. And they talk about justice in the ordinary language sense, where justice consists of things like not assaulting other people, respecting other people's property. So Plato is then shifted the discussion to justice in the sense of having a harmonious soul. But according to Sacks, Plato doesn't really show any relation between harmony in the soul and the ordinary rules of justice. So in his view, and I think there's a lot to be said for his argument, there's the challenge of Glaucon and Adeimantus hasn't been met, because even if his view about what happiness consists of is harmonious soul is right, it doesn't tell us why we ought to be just in the ordinary language sense. I should say, just in passing, I knew David Satchin, but this author, he was one of the three most sarcastic people I've ever met. There are all sorts of funny stories I could tell you about him. I remember once, I'll just give you one time I was sitting in a seminar he was giving, and there was a very heavy person, some really fat person. So I said to him later on, "Who was that rather heavy set person there?" And he said, "Heavy set, is that what you call it?" And I said, "Maybe that was a bit of an understatement." He said, "Understatement, I'd call it more a euphemism." That was just one of his milder comments, but he had many more sarcastic ones than that. Maybe I can mention some in the discussion. So, now to get back to Plato and Socrates, after Socrates presents this notion of justice as the harmony of the soul, Plato, speaking to Socrates, arrives at his account of the best city. So we start with a city where each person follows his economic interests. And he's thinking of, I think, of the actual history of Athens. And we can have a society where agriculture is predominate, but there's a division of labor. People aren't just all doing the same thing, but they're specialized and they're exchanging their mutual advantage. In Plato, as Murray Rothbard pointed out in his History of Economic Thought, was one of the first to write about division of labor. Maybe some of you were in the course. I gave two courses on Roth's History of Economic Thought. So in the first one that we discussed Plato on economics. So Plato knew about division of labor and advantage of it. So this first city sounds, even though it's not very advanced economically, it sounds like something that would be very congenial to libertarians, because we have a market where we have division of labor. But according to Plato, this city is deficient. Now, what's wrong with it? Well, it lacks unity, because you have all these people just specializing their own activity. There's no one planning everything for the whole society. It's people are just acting on their own, and they're making exchanges for their mutual benefit, but so you don't have unity. Also, once luxuries can be produced, say the society develops economically, then the city is in danger of being dominated by wealth. So you can see this is very much like some of the criticisms of capitalism people give even today. Well, we have a free market, then the rich are going to control things because they have more money, so they get more power. So this republic is anticipating one of these criticisms of capitalism that's been very influential. So how do you achieve unity? Remember, Plato says that this city isn't unified, and this city where you have kind of a market society. He says, well, one way you can achieve unity is through a war, because everybody's joined together to conquer the other city-state or whoever you're fighting. And so he likes that. He says unity achieved by war is a good thing. In fact, there's one writer, Leon Craig, who's a follower of Strauss, has a book called Plato, the War Lover. So Plato, at least in some parts, it seems very sympathetic to war, although in the ideal city, Gallipolis, it isn't one that's engaged in war. But he likes this notion of unity that you can get in war. So you can see he doesn't think there's a problem with this kind of market-based city, because he calls it the city of pigs. And he says what's wrong with it is that it's not guided by reason. So in a good city, in the ideal city, the philosophers are entitled to rule and guide the city. And here I'm just going to mention very briefly, I'm not going to get into Plato's metaphysics, but what he thought, in very rough summary, that there are certain ideas which are not as concepts in people's minds. We think of ideas that I have, or you have, as just ideas in people's minds. But he thought ideas or forms were actually existing out there in the world. They're entities. Just like we have tables and chairs, there are also forms. And in fact, these forms are more real than, say, physical objects. And the most important of these forms is called the form of the good. And this you could see only by intensive philosophical study. So the philosophers have seen the form of the good, and they're entitled to rule and guard the city. And in Gallipolis, they're called the guardians. Now, there's another class of people who are the auxiliaries, and they're a military or police force who carry out the will of the guardian. And everyone else is a producer. So there are people who are producing things that we have. People in the market, you know, like they're producing things and exchanging them. So Plato says that's not enough. We have to have a guardian class of people who philosophers and philosophy kings who grasp reason, and then we have auxiliaries who carry out the will of the guardian, because what if people don't do what the guardians say? Well, then the auxiliaries will make sure they do. Interesting, the word that Plato uses for auxiliaries is episcopate, which is, we get the term from bishops, episcopal from that. So auxiliary term is episcopate. Now, I think if we look at this from kind of from a libertarian point of view, we see a problem that Plato really didn't have the idea of a spontaneous order. Say, we look at it from a libertarian point of view, influenced, say, by Mises or Hayek, we can say, well, if you have a market, you don't need to have a central agency directing it. In fact, you can't have a central agency that's able to direct the market. But Plato really didn't have this idea, and he thought society had to be controlled from the center. And Nietzsche is another person, much later, who held that view. So society has to be controlled from the center, so it has to be guided by reason, and it's the philosophers who grasp the form of good, so they're entitled to rule everybody else. Now, in this ideal city, the guardians and the auxiliaries aren't allowed to own property. Also, they aren't allowed to marry or to form permanent attachments, so you couldn't have a girlfriend or boyfriend. And reproduction is very carefully controlled by the laws that Plato was very interested in, eugenics, or the idea that you can get good people by breeding the right kind of people. So reproduction in the guardian class would just be, and the auxiliaries would just occur on certain intervals fixed by the law. Now, the whole point is controversial. I think the most plausible reading is that these restrictions, namely you can't own property and you can't marry, just apply to the guardians and auxiliaries. They don't apply to the producers, most people, so people can, most people, unless you're a guardian, you could just be living your life kind of a regular way. Plato is a bit suspicious of people getting too wealthy, but he doesn't require equality or communism among the producers. So the basic idea is that the guardians are supposed to be complete public service, so kind of the opposite. You know, now we have a school of economic thought called public choice, which is to say that when you're analyzing the government, instead of thinking the government as public servants, you say, well, people in the government are self-interested actors who are trying to pursue their own private interests. So Plato's view is the reverse of that. It's the exact opposite. Well, the guardian class and auxiliaries are completely devoted to the public good, so they're not allowed to have any private interests. Now, in this ideal city, education and the arts are very carefully controlled to keep out harmful ideas. For example, some of the classics, such as Homer, was the greatest, the Odyssey, the greatest Greek classic, weren't allowed, and also Hesiod wasn't allowed, his writings, like Works and Days, weren't allowed, because those writings teach that the gods are in conflict, and instead we should have this harmonious view of the universe. Now, you might think, well, okay, this is the guardians might think this is good, and the auxiliaries might think this is good, but why would the producers accept this? Because after all, would say you're a producer, why would you want to have the guardian tell you what to do, even if you said, well, I'm a philosopher, I've seen the good and the good, why would you accept that? So he thought that Plato said, well, people would be taught what he called the noble lie, that they would be told that people really reflect or produce according to certain metals, like the guardians would be gold and the producers would be base metals. So somehow there would be kind of a system of education that would get people to accept that the guardians were a superior group entitled to rule. Now, Plato thought that it would be very unlikely that this city could be achieved, but it would be the best possible if it did exist. So some people say, well, he's just coming up with this kind of project, just kind of describing an ideal city, but didn't really reflect his own views. But he does seem to have thought that if you could put this into practice, it would be a good thing. Now, there's a famous attack on Plato, and very influential one, called The Open Society and Its Enemies by Karl Popper. In the first volume of that, Popper argues that Plato was a precursor of the Nazis, in that he said Plato wanted to return to what he calls a tribal society. What Popper thinks is that in a commercial society, as Athens was starting to become, people had divergent interests, but Plato didn't like that. He wanted a very tight and unified society, and Popper thinks this is the Nazis were aiming at that also. And Popper placed a great deal of stress on the regulations I mentioned about breeding, and he sees this as ancestral to Nazi racism. So what Popper did, was really take the Nazi interpretation of Plato, as the Nazi scholars really viewed Plato as a racist, sort of precursor of racism, and someone who wanted to close the society. They thought, well, this is a great thing, Plato's really anticipating National Socialism. So Popper said, yeah, that's right, he is, but it's a very bad thing. But I think always very much worth reading. I know Hayek thought very highly of the book. He thought, he told me he thought Popper was right on Plato, but thought it was too hard on Aristotle. But I think it goes too far, because in the Ideal City, the activities of the producers are largely left alone. So in that respect, it was not the same as the later totalitarian. So now someone just asked, I'll take the last thing I said, how does Plato define the unity society? Well, by unity means it simply controlled the guardians are supposed to represent reason. So they decide, they plan for society, they decide all any questions that come up. They decide according to their knowledge of the good. So that's what I mean by that. So what I'm going to do now, the rest of them will have questions and discussion. I'm going to open this Q&A box so you can type your question in there if you like. I'm also going to, if you want to put in the chat, I guess that's all right too, but I'm going to open this Q&A box, and so then please type your questions in there and I'll read them, so we'll be able to know what everybody will know what the questions are. Okay, does anybody have any questions? Don't all hurry to be the first one. Now, Malcolm said, to what extent did Plato's thoughts on education influence education through the age of the reason example? Well, that's a very good question. Well, Plato was extremely influential. Kind of the most, probably the most influential idea he had was not this notion of censorship, although that influenced later thinkers like Jean-Jacques Rousseau. But in Plato established a place in Athens called the Academy, where people would study. They would study philosophy and also other subjects like mathematics. And this is really the origin of a university, kind of a separate institution for study. So Plato is really the one who founded the modern university, and many educational reformers have looked back to Plato. You can think of people throughout history. There was one, Comenius, who was a figure in the Enlightenment. It was kind of Leibniz, we're looking back on Plato. So he's really the founder of the really modern education in the university. Now, here's a long question here. Do you think that Plato's Socrates' view on the man who chooses not to give a knife to murder is compatible and consistent with libertarianism? And you can choose to violate the non-aggression principle if you're ready to accept the consequences. The other man decides to press charge. I reminded Rothbard's comment, we have its liberty regarding the situation where cops decide to torture a man to get information on him. Rothbard said it's fine that his legal bonus, the cops receive punishment, find out the individual they tortured or innocent. That's an interesting question. I mean, I think there is somewhat of a conflict there, in the sense that on a libertarian ground, if somebody has a right to something, you should give it to them. Although, on the other hand, let's suppose you didn't give the knife to the prospective murderer, and then you took action against you. It wouldn't be very good if he said, if he asked, well, what were you going to do with the knife? He said, well, I was going to go out and kill somebody. He would get into trouble himself. You see, I think there, I mean, I suppose you could just get out of it by saying just delay giving the knife till he's arrested or stop from killing someone. So, I mean, I think there's certainly there's a possibility of conflict there with libertarianism. But, I mean, I think we shouldn't, in things how we apply libertarian principles, there's no reason to abandon common sense and say, oh, well, you know, of course, we have to, if we don't, you remember the famous scene in the movie Not Too Strange One, where somebody needs to, press a certain button on a Coke machine or to save the world from nuclear annihilation, but that he's reluctant to do it because it's private property. And I don't think we want to say, well, our attitude to libertarian rule should be, you know, rules are rules. The world is blown up, so what? You know, after all, we don't want to contradict ourselves by violating the self-ownership principle. And I don't think that's the way to do it. Robert says, I've heard from some science professors that Plato's Republic is some sort of sarcastic spoof and not been taken face down. And he's telling this, well, this is the interpretation that Leo Strauss gave in City of Man, that he thought that he was really making fun of a certain type of philosophical thought. And that isn't, there's something to be said for that, but it isn't the majority opinion. One thing that Strauss says is that in the ideal city, it's one where the philosophers are supposed to rule, but Plato also says that the philosophers don't want to rule, they have to be forced to rule. So, according to Strauss, well, if they have to be forced to rule, then doesn't that show there's something wrong with the idea? But it's not clear what the force, how strong that argument is. And most people haven't been convinced by Strauss's argument, but you should look at them yourself. Now, let's see, one here from Matthew. Plato's singing and reading seems to produce the result of an answer that those who work with the hands are inferior to those who work with the mind. Well, I think he did hold that the philosophers are superior to other people. That's certainly true, but it wouldn't follow from that. I don't see that you want to be lenient toward producers just because of that. I mean, you might, that's compatible. If you think that the producers are inferior, maybe you think they need stronger regulation. I suppose you might get an argument from like him thinking, well, the producer is so inferior that what they're doing really doesn't matter. I don't think that was his view. I see here, does Plato assume that they're not individuals who are made happy by not being just, even if they could be aware of his brand of justice, how would their view of justice be addressed? So you're saying, well, what if somebody says, I'm happy by not being just, even if they're aware of what Plato's saying? They say, well, that isn't what makes me happy. I'm happy by just going out and doing what I want. Forget about this harmony of the soul. But you see, what Plato is saying, it's a much stronger view than there's some sort of connection between justice and happiness. He thinks that happiness is justice in this sense of harmony of the soul. So he would say that if someone says he's made happy by not being just, the person is mistaken because happiness consists of being just in the sense of having a harmonious soul. So if somebody says, well, look, I don't care about harmonious soul, I'm just happy, say, by just going out to the shooting gallery every week and firing a few rounds, that's all I need. He'd say the individual is mistaken. Another question is, did Hayek get the phrase open society from Popper, or was that in common usage? Well, the phrase actually comes, and Popper took it from a book by Henri Bergson, who was a French philosopher, called the Two Sources of Morality in Religion, and he speaks of an open society there. So Popper got it from Bergson, and I think Hayek got it from Popper. But Bergson, in his usage phrase, is different from what Popper meant, because Bergson meant that society was open to transcendence. He had the same contrast of tribal versus free society that Popper gets, but for him the contrast was one that a society that wasn't just bound by custom was open to the revelation from the transcendent. And that's very different from Popper. And I know Eric Vogelin, who was a very influential historian, political philosopher, I used to know, was very anti-Popper. He said, oh, Popper's distorted Bergson because he didn't change the meaning of the old society. So let me see, was there another question up here? Let me see. Did Plato consider justice to be the highest goal of society, or were there other principles like order, prosperity, you consider equal? Oh no, justice is the most important thing. Everything else is subordinate. Order is really a type of justice. It's a harmonious arrangement. So that would be the most important thing. Now, Malcolm says, with regards to Plato and education, you speak of how education was conducted, who was to be educated, what we were to be educated on. Well, I think Plato was somewhat, he was somebody who said people, you would just know from people's early experience, you'd know which people were suitable for education, and they wouldn't have to come from these children with the guardians or auxiliaries, although they would be the most likely to be the ones who get this higher form of education because of the reading, the way they've been bred, but I mean, you could get very good people from the producers also. And if people were qualified, then they would undergo very long training. They'd be taught, you wouldn't get to philosophy until very late in your studies because the view was that only mature people, like people over 30, were suitable for philosophical discussion. Remember, it's written over the portals of the academy. Let none ignorant of geometry enter here, so you have to know math first. So that would be one thing you'd study first. And the education would just take place by study among small groups of people, like the supervision of the philosophers. Now, Eric said, what were considered harmful ideas in education? Well, harmful ideas would be ones that would promote discord, like, say, literature that would show the gods fighting with each other. You know, in Greek religion, you always had the gods, like Zeus was always fighting with the other gods, or there were people, gods trying to supplant each other, have affairs with each other. So that would be kind of, that would be an example of something that was harmful. Kind of harmful idea would be something like maybe the guardian shouldn't be ruling society, people should be free to do what they want. That wouldn't be allowed. George says, what did you think of Robert Nisbet's The Quest for Community? If I remember correctly, doesn't he try to give some environmental sociological reasons for why men like Plato held the views they did? Could you please explain Nisbet's view? I think Quest for Community is a very good book. Nisbet had some very good ideas. Now, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, it's been a long time since I've looked at Nisbet. I think what he suggests is that Plato, you get this a little bit in Popper's book also, is that Plato, remember, came from a very aristocratic family. And Athens at that time, there was a struggle between the Democrats and the more aristocratic party. So I think the view that would be that Plato was really trying to restore an aristocratic society, but he didn't like the idea of the democratic commercial society as Athens was becoming one to go back to an earlier ideal, kind of more agricultural society, where there wouldn't be a lot of change, where people would just follow the old and good values of the past. So I think that would be, again, I'd have to check Nisbet to see where that's at. I think that's what, probably what he had in mind, but I have to check that. I could be entirely wrong on that, but I think that's what's coming to mind. And somebody says here, the downcracks in the oligarchs. Yeah, that's right. Right. Plato was aligned with the oligarchs. Now, Sam says, how does one determine specific just action within this framework? Well, that's a very good question. You know, that's a that relates to this objection David Sacks had, where he says this notion of harmony of a soul really doesn't have a direct relation with justice in the ordinary language sense. But what Plato seems to have thought is that people who could really grasp the form of the good would be, have judgment on particular cases. They wouldn't be following fixed rules, but they would, because of their perception of the good, they would know what to do in particular situations, and things that would have certain virtues that they would acquire just by studying the good, and then just by sizing up the situation, they know what to do. Now, here's one Matthew Tenenbaum was also starting at place against the Greek. Get rid of Hesiod and Homer, having seen what happened to his mentor. If the Greeks had a Bible, it was a Homeric cycle in Hesiod's poems. Well, I think maybe he thought that it was that it is. He was very upset at what had happened to Socrates. Remember, Socrates finally charged them with impiety toward God. So he thought, well, if people executed Socrates, they'd probably have the wrong view. They have the wrong view of the gods. If we had the correct view, they wouldn't have done such a terrible thing. Now, Joe says, aren't they the same thing? I'm not clear what are they supposed to be the same thing. Now, Trent says, the guardians had seen the form of good and knew better than the producers. Why would they have to be forced to be rulers? Ah, that's a very good question. Well, because they prefer to keep studying the form of the good and learning more about it, then they wouldn't want to, if they had to rule the producers, that's taking time away from their philosophical studies. And that's what they're really getting the most out of this philosophical study. So something like imagine you're like being drafted into the army rather than do what you were doing before. Now, Jay says, how do you think Plato would explain conflict between two just cities? In two cities with functioning guardians or auxiliaries, where he views such conflict as impossible. Well, he doesn't really discuss that much. He seems to think the ideal city, you see, why the basic reason you had conflict in among the Greek cities, he thought was expanding population. So cities, the people in the city would want to conquer other cities so they could have more space for their people. But remember, in the ideal city, everything's done greetings control, although maybe not so much among the producers, but he thought this wouldn't be as much of a problem. But he doesn't really discuss that much. He doesn't discuss conflicts between the cities, although I don't think he thought it would be impossible. Don says, would it not be better to come to complete understanding the form of the good before attempting to rule? It seems kind of like rushing into something with only half a picture. That's a very good question I suppose Plato would just say, well, your knowledge of the form of good is enough to enable you to rule. You might always learn more about it, wouldn't be what you would learn more, wouldn't supplant what you've already learned. You know enough to rule. So if you have to, if you're trying to construct an ideal city, your knowledge of the form of the good would be enough for you. So that's a very good question. Let's see, I think we have time. We're about on time. Does anybody have one last question? I think we're out of time now. George says, on Nisbet, I think had the diminishing intermediate institution where you saw social chaos and you get rid of it by statism, but didn't in Nisbet you see the chaos actually resulting from its shrinkage of these intermediate institutions? Yes, that's something you find in Rousseau also, in Nisbet's interpretation of Rousseau. You know, Rousseau would say, we don't want to have intermediate institutions. Of course, for Nisbet, these institutions, like intermediate between the family and the state, are all important. So I think that's right, Nisbet does say that. You're quite right. Let's see. To go back to the beginning of the lecture, if there are objective non-relevant questions, you can potentially ask them throughout history. It seems to me people might ask different questions different times, but it still makes maybe possible to nonetheless look at what they particularly just see as possible to deduce from their particular point of view an answer that relates to objective and non-relevant questions. To disagree entirely seems to be an almost relativistic point of view. I think that's a very good point. I think Collingwood was a relativist in this way. So I think that's right, that the challenge I was giving to the point of view I'll be attempting to give in this course was a relativist one. Okay, I see one. Is the analogy of a body to the city a valid analogy? Well, remember, it's not an analogy of the body to the city, it's an analogy of the mind to the city. And there are very serious questions about that. Very good question asked, Trumbull asked that. Bernard Williams, who's a very important British philosopher, 20th century British philosopher, said, no, this isn't a good analogy because in the city, it's separate people who are supposed to parallel each part of the mind, like the guardians are representing the reason, the auxiliaries represent the will, and the producers represent desire. But so the people in the city, if that's right, aren't themselves unified. Each one is just emphasizing a particular function of mind. So he thought that was a big problem in the analogy. Well, let me see, I guess, do we have anything else here? Okay, I guess that's it then for today. So I'll have somebody says something here. Thanks. Somebody says something. What was this? Eric says when Lenin Marx follows a play. No, not at all. Is ideas for society lead to what Lenin wanted in their own country, a populist program from education believes where it was always just because they were for the common good. Well, I think you can get certain Platonic elements in Plato and Marx, but they didn't view themselves within the Platonic tradition. But I think you're right, you could see certain ways that there's similarity. That Bastiat was one who in the law emphasized that the socialist planners are one who want to impose their will, their plans on the rest of society, and I think that's a theme you get in Plato that you'll find in socialist thinkers also, so that was a good point. Okay, well, thanks everybody. Hope we'll see you all next week. Bye everybody.